they're bringing more seats. So don't leave. Don't leave. I wish they brought more air conditioning. Well, my answer to you right off the bat is that I am an optimist about the future of journalism. Cockeyed optimist, as we say in America. And I think that future is an entrepreneurial future, not institutional. That's not to say the institutions will die, but they have had, as of October, 16 years since the introduction of the commercial browser to change their world. And they've changed, but only so much. And so I think that the future is necessarily entrepreneurial, and that's why I teach entrepreneurial journalism. Indeed, if I were not an optimist about the future of journalism, I would be defrauding young people by teaching them in a journalism school. Every year when we start the school, I try to scare the shit out of them by putting up all the figures about how bad things are in the business. And the first year, I was telling someone this morning, the first year I taught that class, I was going through this litany of all the shrinkage in journalism, and one of the students, honest to God, put her head in her hands and said, "Oh my God, I've made a terrible mistake. I've come to the wrong place." I said, "Stop. It'll be okay." What I then say to these students is that there is an incredible, incredible opportunity to reinvent and create things. It's kind of awkward here, perfect. I'm trying to ignore you, you're in my back to you. There's a chance to create things in this world. So I don't want to plug my university, but I want to give this context. We just announced a few days ago at City University of New York a grant from the Tau Foundation and the Knight Foundation to establish the Center for Entrepreneurial Journalism at CUNY, which I'll direct. And it has three legs to the stool. The first is education. We are going to offer what we think is the first MA degree in the US in entrepreneurial journalism. I'll tell you more about that in a second. We're going to continue the research that we've been doing about new models, business models for news. I'll tell you more about that in a second. And the third leg of the stool is that we're going to incubate businesses, and if I'm lucky and figure out all the legalities and raise a little more money, invest in new businesses in journalism. Our goal is to say that what Stanford and MIT in the US bring to the technology industry, no one brings to journalism. And if there is a bright future for journalism, and if it is entrepreneurial, then we've got to build it. That's why I tell the students it's up to them. It's not a question of waiting and getting a job somewhere. They have to build it. And they have to create these new ventures and these new things. So I've been teaching this course at my school for 4 years now in entrepreneurial journalism. The students create a business plan for a sustainable journalistic enterprise. By sustainable, I mean profitable. They come in, many of them, and they say, "Oh, it's okay, I don't have to worry about business, we'll be not-for-profit." No. Begging for money doesn't work in the long run. It does maybe in the short run. And of course, we have a different structure in the US where we have so little government support for media, which I think is a fine thing. And we have some more charitable support. We have more charitable foundation reflexes than you have in Europe. But nonetheless, we cannot rely on, I think, either charity or government or God to give us journalism. We have to build it. And in the discussion about the business of journalism, we've been concentrating really on just two aspects, two revenue streams, advertising and subscription. And what we leave out of this is the other side of the ledger, is the cost side of the ledger, and how much less expensive it can be to do journalism now because it can be collaborative and in a network and targeted and specialized and efficient. And that sounds perhaps a little bit harsh to use the word efficiency with journalism, but I think that we wasted a lot of money for many years. And again, I'm very, very conscious here of how different the US market is from European markets. In European markets, you've had robust national brands, you've had a choice and diversity of brands and voices in media. In the US, because of our distance, the New York Times could not become a national newspaper until the satellite came along to send its plates to printing presses across the country, even before the internet, and that was in the 70s. So we've had, in the U.S., once TV killed the second and third newspapers in towns, we've had monopoly newspapers. And those monopolies became one size fits all, and allegedly objective, and boring, and raised a lot of resentment in the market. I think there's more resentment about the papers in the U.S. than there is from what I find here. When I go visit Germany, for example, I meet with the editors at Die Zeit, and they remind me that their circulation is still going up. Congratulations. I think that's wonderful, and I know these markets are very different. But I think that the dynamics of the internet are universal. And when I speak even with executives, I've met a few in India, where, of course, print is going up like crazy, and the World Association of Newspapers will say, print's fine, it's okay, it's growing somewhere. The smart executives there are saying, no, we can't rest on that. The internet is everywhere. It's going to be everywhere. We're going to have 3 billion people coming on mobile phones. This is going to change our world. So the question becomes how we do this. Let me just give you the small laboratory of my class. In my class, students must come up with, as I said, a business plan for a sustainable journalistic enterprise. And I treat the definition of journalism very broadly. To me, it means that you help a community organize its information. I'm going to obnoxiously drop a name in a place right now. At Davos a few years ago, Mark Zuckerberg from Facebook was in a room with a bunch of media executives about like this, powerful people. And it's off the record, but I asked Mark whether I could quote this story. I didn't ask the executive who was questioning it. A very powerful newspaper executive, the scion of a major newspaper family in the U.S., was near me in a new building that people like to climb. begged Zuckerberg, just begged him and said, Mark, how do we get a community like you? We should be able to build a community like you. How do we do that? You own a community, we should, right? And Zuckerberg, being, as I guess we'll see soon in this movie, a geek of few words, said in full, this is a passion, please, full response was, you can't. And he did that kind of geek stare where it makes you nervous, doesn't it? You know, keep staring at something, right? And but he came back later and he said, you're asking the wrong questions, media executives. You don't make communities. Communities already exist. They're doing what they want to do. The question you should ask is, how do you help the community do what it wants to do better? And his prescription for that was that you bring the community, and I quote, elegant organization. I love that phrase, elegant organization. And isn't that, in a sense, what we as journalists aspire to do, is to help a community organize its knowledge so it can organize itself, right? Now, the economics of this with the internet have changed radically. So just as people do not need us anymore to sell a car or a couch, they don't need us anymore necessarily to share what they know. The marginal cost of a community sharing information is zero. That could be scary if you think that you're a middleman and a gatekeeper in this process. And no, that's what we do for a living. We print papers, no. We broadcast stories, no. We gatekeep information, no. The community can do that on their own. The question we as journalists have to ask is, where do we add value? How do we add value? And we can afford to do only that which adds value. If we waste our time and our resources anymore doing commodity journalism, repetitive journalism, journalism of stories you already know, production, that's where the waste is. There's incredible and huge waste. So, in my class, sustainable journalistic enterprise. And I'll give you the list of what they have to do. It's very simple. It's the same for the journalistic business as any other business. The first thing they have to do, in the order of things, but it's the last thing they end up doing in the class, is their elevator pitch. And when they come in, I have a new crop of students right now, and they come in and they have a very loosey-goosey, unsure description of what they want to do. And it gets crystallized and focused more and more and more. And if you can't describe your business in a tweet, it's probably not a business. And if you can't describe it in that economical way. So they do that, they do a needs statement. Why does this business need to exist? They do a market analysis. Who is this serving? Who are those people? How big is it? They do a competitive analysis. And students tend to think, I have no competitors, but of course we all do, and you want competitors. They do a product plan, obviously. What is the product? They do a revenue plan. which is usually advertising, but not always. I had a student last year who had a business in high-end financial who was going to charge $1,000 a month. And even though I'm accused of being against paid content, I'm not. I'm just against trying to do it when I don't think it's going to work, Mr. Murdoch. So they do a revenue plan. They do a marketing or distribution plan. Everyone's going to come in and say, I'll be viral. And they have to push a little farther than that. They do an operations plan, that's the cost. They do a launch plan, because we have this great advantage nowadays. We don't have to launch the whole thing at once. We can launch a bit at a time and prove that we know what we're doing and get more audience and then get some revenue and then use that to build the next phase. And that's a great gift of this world entrepreneurially. And then finally, they do an ask. What are they going to ask investors for? And we've been very lucky in the last few years. I've had $100,000 from the McCormick Foundation that we used to give seed money to, as it turns out, 7 of the students' businesses. And those students are now incubating those businesses at CUNY, at the university. And part of the advantage we have in getting this new grant is that I can improve the incubation services and give them more. Because what happens is that the jurors, the jury is made up of venture capitalists, editors, publishers, entrepreneurs, and technologists. And it's a great day. It's a fun day. Students have 5 minutes to pitch their business, 5 minutes of questions. We go in, we have lines, and we vote. And figure out that actually, I don't vote. By the way, if you want to motivate students, screw grades. Money doesn't. Money is a great motivator in class. And the first year, this is a little dynamic in this, the first year the students were highly competitive about that. In the following years, they were nicer, and they help each other's businesses. They root for each other. So I now have 7 businesses incubating at the school. One student, Jenny Abens, is doing a business called Closet Tour, where she wants to bring to fashion what the Omnivore's Dilemma brought to food. And you can see her stuff at closettour.com. She's used $9,000 to make 3 webisodes to prove herself, and now she's meeting with major media companies and investors and trying to figure out what goes next. One student is working on an algorithm to help you categorize some of your input each day. I won't say anything more because it's her business. One is about to come out with an iPod app for discussing sports. Again, I'll keep that a little vague on purpose. Another has a site for the Ugandan diaspora in the US and the UK called Ugandans Abroad. Another student is still investigating whether she can deliver radio shows as phone calls in her home in Nigeria. Some tricky stuff there. Two students worked on an assignment tool for editors to assign citizens. And I'm forgetting one. Whatever. Sorry. So that gives you an idea of the breadth of this. They're trying to invent new enterprises and do what they want. As I said before, I'm generous about the definition of journalism. Oh, I know the other one. One's called Notebooks with a K, which has turned into a platform for teachers and students to share curriculum. How the hell is that journalism? It's kind of not me anymore. The original was going to have news. But I don't really care, A, because he's graduated, and B, because he's found that's what the market wants, and that's what a good entrepreneur does. I sat in a meeting the other day where a professor was bugging him that he's working with MIT and SUNY in New York, and this professor said, I want to teach business using your tool, and you don't let me do it, and he found a market, and he's changing his business. I had the students from last year and this year in the same class, and it's fascinating to see how after 1 year, or 9 months actually, the graduates are rethinking their world. They're talking about getting next round funding, they're talking about the operations, they're talking about how there's always something changing in their business. Imagine how different that is from our journalistic world. They're always changing something. And they recognize that they're changing the business fundamentally. So, that's kind of that part of the program. And we can talk about any of this anymore as you want. I'm going to skip the presentation stuff. The slides, I'll just talk you through it. We also held 3 conferences at CUNY so far in New Business Models for Years. And at one of them, Jim Brady, who at the time was at WashingtonPost.com as the editor, was in one of the breakout groups, because every conference has to have a breakout group, and was mapping out the newsroom of the future. And he sent me pictures from this the other day. He had the whiteboard, he had the numbers on the whiteboard,
And he said, little did he think that at that moment what he was drawing, he would later launch as TBD.com. TBD is a new local news site in Washington. It's started by Politico. It is associated with some TV stations in town, but otherwise it is a very entrepreneurial effort. And I think it's a very telling effort about the economics of news going forward. Brady has, I think, a total staff of 50. I think that's right, Mark. And a newsroom of about 35. He is working with a network of 150 bloggers in the DC area. His business goal is for the bloggers to succeed, because the more they succeed, the less he has to do with his spare resources. He also operates under my favorite bumper sticker line of my own, which is do what you do best and link to the rest. If you go to TBD, it is an excellent curation, one of our wonderfully overused words these days. It is a wonderful curation of news. So if the Washington Post does a great job on a story, he doesn't redo it. There's none of this egotistical thing that we used to have in print that we had to deliver it ourselves as well. He links directly to the Post. Not to a summary of the Post, straight to the Post. Not to a summary of the blogger, straight to the blogger. So that's the ethic of the link in the link economy. He wants them to succeed. Now, compare Brady's enterprise with 50 people, 35 newsroom, with Catherine Weymouth's, the Washington Post, where my numbers are at all current about 750 in the newsroom and about probably 2,000 employees overall. Well, there's probably no way that Weymouth can resize, as we say, to the proper size for this new world. And she can start, Jim Brady can start from scratch here. So when we come to Europe and see very successful large enterprises, and some of them are still growing, and my friends in Europe say, well, we don't have that same problem. I don't know that that's true. I say you should look at us in America as the canary in the coal mine, and the canary has flopped over in the cage, because it's internet dynamic. And it's not just the classified died, it's not just the retail died, it's not just the people don't trust that they were not buying as much. It's also that entrepreneurs can come in for very, very little money and disrupt you and do something more specialized and better. So when I want technology business news, yeah, I read the New York Times, and it's pretty good, but TechCrunch is amazing. When I want media news, yes, the New York Times is pretty good, but paid content, Rafa, thank you very much, is phenomenal. And the New York Times cannot possibly match the depth of both. That's why the Washington Post now runs TechCrunch content itself, which is smart to do. You should do best link to the rest. But the point is that I think that if there were an entrepreneurial spirit here in Europe as well, and there is, that will bubble up at moments and will disrupt some of the old big players. And they'd best watch out for that. Or they'd best help it along. And I would argue that perhaps they should invest. So in Germany, Holzbrink has its lab, has been investing in companies, and I think that's a great idea. It's risky, it's hard. It's hard for companies to then take these ventures inside and do those things, but I think that there's a great deal of opportunity there. I want to tell you for a few minutes about the work we've done in new business models for news. At CUNY, like everyone, we listen to the conversation about the business future of news, and what we hear is a lot of mourning and whining. And the people actually say to me, you know, Jarvis, what happens when your internet, thank you very much, kills paper? So we decided to look at that. And it's a bit controversial because I don't want to kill papers. I love papers. My basement is filled with my clips my wife can't stand. I'm a romantic about papers. But people like horses too. Things change. What we have to teach more than anything else is change. So we wanted to get specifics in this discussion, rather than generalisms. And so we looked at what would happen in a market of 5 million people, which for us is, you know, a large market, but only a fraction of the country. In other countries, it's the whole country, I'm aware of that. But it's about the size of Boston. What happens if the Boston Globe folded? And at the time we started this, it was looking like it might, because the New York Times was going to abandon the child, no one else was gonna buy it. So fine, let's face the devil. What would happen if the Boston Globe folded? And a few things became apparent to us. One is that it's not as if the big old company is replaced by a big new company. Instead, what we see already emerging is an ecosystem of many different players operating under many different motives and means and business models. And so we then did research on that. And we talked to hyperlocal bloggers scattered across the country. And it's not as if they're all like this, but we found bloggers here and there who are bringing in today, covering markets of 50,000 people. They're bringing in $200,000 revenue. And mind you, these are journalists who don't know shit about business or sales or advertising. Kind of in spite of themselves, they're making a living. They're making a sustainable journalistic enterprise. And so then we asked, what would it take to optimize that, to make that better? And we have two answers. The first is to try to improve what they sell. The second is to create networks. The idea of just selling banners and buttons to local advertisers isn't going to work. We have to ask what those advertisers want. So we at CUNY are out right now doing research with local advertisers in Brooklyn. We, a journalism school, are researching advertising because we want to pay for the journalists. We're working with the New York Times. The New York Times started the blog The Local. We did it together as a joint venture in Brooklyn, and the New York Times couldn't afford to have a full-time staffer on it anymore, so we took it over at the school. We now run The Local. My friend and colleague and competitor, Jay Rosen, now has a version of The Local in the East Village in Manhattan, and there are a few others around the country. So we run The Local, and what became apparent with The Local is to get into the business model, it's got to operate in an ecosystem and network of bloggers, and to make them succeed, they've got to find a way to get paid. And to make that work, we believe in our modeling that they have to work in networks. So we're doing research now with local advertisers to see what is it that they want and need, and then we are going to try to do training of new people, citizen sales. Heard about citizen journalism, well, how about citizen sales? How about new sales forces of people who can sell in new ways? This is all absolutely unproven. We don't know what's going to work, but if you start with this basis of $200,000 a year that we know bloggers can make today, we think they could get $350,000. And again, in this hypothetical market, there's also no major paper for the whole market, so there's money there to be had as well, if you can get things in networks. The key is that a given blogger can't walk into a major retailer and say, give me the ad, because they're too small. The retailer can't deal with 100 of these. But if someone walks in and says, I have the best 50 here, there are ones, the retailer is probably going to say, okay, especially because the price is better than they were used to paying. Mark Potts, who started Backfence, is now working on a company called Growth Spur that is going to attempt to start with these networks and train these new sales forces. Michael Rosenblum, who some of you may know, who's brought one-man bands into the journalism market in video, is also working on a means to produce video. There are nascent efforts here, but I think we desperately need the networks. So we did this research looking at what the bloggers' world looks like. We looked at a new news organization. We still believe it exists in a market like this. In fact, before we did it, it ends up looking a lot like TBD. Jim Brady starting in Washington. It has a couple dozen journalists, it has 40, 50 staff, it sells the ads for this network. It's a business, but it's a smaller business. That, I think, we projected as a $20 million business. Boston Globe last year brought in $400 million revenue. But it's profitable. That's the key. In business, we keep looking at not the bottom line, but the top line. We keep on looking at size. How big is it? That's not the way to manage business anymore. I think that's true across many industries, that innovation is going to lead to efficiency more than growth. And so we saw this idea that's a book I want to write, but I'm not an economist, so I'm not qualified for it. I might do it anyway, because what economists know. So we saw that there were sustainable, profitable enterprises in this market, and then we added it all up at the end. At the end, we saw that there was about $45 million revenue that we believed was credible. And that's also credible from the other end, is that that's about, newspapers are getting in between 8 and 12 and 15% of their revenue digital. So just for the Globe alone, and it shows incredible potential for growth. That sustained about 250 full-time equivalent to content people, aka journalists, versus, I don't know what that market has, 300, 350 in the newsroom. It's an equivalent number, and as I said before, it's a very different relationship with the public, far closer to the community, far more answerable and accountable to the community, not doing repetitive news, commodity news production. So I could argue that we may actually improve journalism this way. As Clay Shirky says, that's the other rule of conferences, you must quote Clay Shirky once in every talk, because he's so damn quotable. And I say this with great respect. Clay says, you know, everything will work and nothing will work. We don't know. Nothing may work. It's true. There's no guarantee here. I offer no guarantees. But I'm optimistic that society will show a demand for quality journalism. And if that's the case, the next question is, can we meet that demand? Can the market meet that demand? And that's what we try to do in our research.